All right, what a blessing it's been to see each of you here tonight. And I think most of you know by now that the plan is to preach through the entire Bible in 2026. Or as the New Testament calls it in Acts 20, verse 27, the whole counsel of God. And there's only one way to get the whole counsel of God, in my understanding, is to preach through the entire Bible. So that's what we're planning to do. Now, my plan is, I think most of you know, to preach through the Bible in Sunday morning, Sunday evening. But from time to time, I will add a portion in Wednesday night. Now, when I do it on Wednesday nights, I'm not going to supplant anything that I plan to do on Sunday, but it's going to be sometimes additional stuff. So that's what I'm going to be doing tonight. It's an addition to what we covered on Sunday. So if you turn in your Bibles to Genesis here for just a moment, and I want to talk a little bit more and give you a little bit of additional thought here. And you'll see up in the left-hand corner of this slide, it says number 2.5. That means that Sunday morning was number 1, Sunday evening was number 2, and this is number 2.5. This coming Sunday morning will be number 3, so this is kind of in the middle there. All right, so if that makes sense to you, I just want to give a little additional thought. I was going so fast and covering so much on Abraham Sunday night, I just didn't feel like I could get it all. And so I'm going to give you a little extra stuff here tonight. And I want us to conclude, and it's kind of a tie-in, it's kind of a bridge between Sunday night and what I'm going to do this coming Sunday morning. Because I begin with chapter 25, and I'm going to be talking about Isaac and Jacob. Putting those two men together. Now, just by way of review here, this is the entire book of Genesis here. There's four key events in the first 11 chapters. Those four key events are creation, the fall, the flood, and Babel, Tower of Babel. Then there are four key individuals in the second part of Genesis. You've got their names. They're Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. The first 11 chapters take at least 2,000 years, and the second part of Genesis only takes 300 years maximum, probably less than that. The beginning of the world is found in the first 11 chapters, and the beginning of the nation of Israel is in the second part. We have the east location where what is known as the Fertile Crescent, where the whole world population began there where the Garden of Eden was, and the second part moves west to come to the area of Palestine, or the land of Canaan, we call it, or it is what is known as the Promised Land, where Israel would grow. And so Abraham is this key founding father of the nation of Israel. He's the most well-known name in the Bible other than Jesus himself. And so Abraham is the key individual that we've looked at. We looked at him from chapter 12 through 24 because it tells his life. And I'm going to give you a summary of that in a moment when we look towards the end of this. But in the meantime, I want us to just look at this chapter in a moment. We'll look at this, but I want to see for a moment here the fact that he was a wayward prophet. I want to back up and talk about that for a moment. If you look at chapter 20 for a moment, we're just going to do a little survey here, and I'm not going to give a lot of details, but in chapter 20, we see him as the wayward prophet. It's the deja vu all over again. What happens when he comes to Gerar? He fails to consult God. In verse 1, it says, Abraham journeyed from there toward the Negev and dwelt between Kadesh and Shur, and sojourned in Gerar. And Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, she is my sister, verse 2 says, and Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, behold, thou art but a dead man for the woman whom thou hast taken, for she is a man's wife. And Abimelech had not come near her, and he said, Lord, wilt thou slay also a righteous nation? Said he not unto me, she is my sister, and she herself said, he's my brother. In the integrity of my heart and innocency of my hands have I done this. And God said unto him in a dream, verse 6, yea, I know that thou didst this in the integrity of thy heart, for I also withheld thee from sinning against me. Therefore allowed I not thee to touch her. So we have this scene here where Abraham does, he fails to consult God and he lies again. It's a lack of faith and he mistreats the marriage covenant. He is putting his, allowing his wife to be out there in a dangerous position by lying about who she is. He's not telling this man that she's married and she's my wife. And so Abimelech takes her and says, okay, she, as far as he was concerned, she's fair game. And I may take this woman into my wife. She might become my wife. And so it brings consequences. It brings consequences. Abraham is lying. How embarrassing is that? The great prophet of God is lying. We find out that he's the man of faith, but he's also a liar at times. Isn't it interesting to note that sometimes some of the greatest people in the Bible, including Abraham, and then later on we'll see a guy by the name of David, who's called a man after God's own heart. And what does he do? He lies. He commits adultery. He murders. How terrible. And so we find that Abraham is dealing with this whole thing. But I want you to see next verse here, verse 7, because God is speaking to Abimelech, this pagan king here, and what does he say in verse 7? He says, now therefore restore the man his wife, for he is a prophet, and he shall pray for thee, and thou shalt live, and if thou restore her not, know thou that thou shalt surely die, thou and all that are thine. He says, you better talk to Abraham, and you better ask him to pray for you because he's a prophet. If you don't give his wife back to him, if you mess around with her, you're a dead man. But if you give her back and you ask him and he prays for you, your life will be spared. But if you don't, not only will you die, but everybody in your house is going to die. Major consequences. So what happens? So here's what happens. Abraham, we find out, is a prophet here. And God treats his prophets very special. You say, I don't think God should have treated him very special right here, this time because he was a liar. But here's what happens. Verse 8, therefore Abimelech rose early in the morning and called all his servants and told all these things in their ears. And the men were very much afraid. They were scared spitless. They say, man, what's going on here? This is God's man and he's lying to us and now we're in trouble for it. Verse 9, then Abimelech called Abraham and said unto him, what have you done unto us? And what have I offended thee that thou hast brought on me in my kingdom a great sin? You have sinned against us. Verse 9, thou hast done these deeds unto me that ought not to be done. You should have never done this. You were bad. Isn't that amazing that a pagan has to confront a believer and tell him that he's sinning? That's what's happening here. In verse 10, and Abimelech said unto Abraham, what didst thou have in view that thou hast done this thing? Why did you do this? What was in your mind? Verse 11, and Abraham said, because I thought, surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will slay me for my wife's sake. So I was afraid. I have a question. Should we do something that is sinful because we're afraid? Should we, any of us, sin because we're afraid? I was afraid, that's why I lied. I was afraid, that's why I stole it. I was afraid, that's why I killed him. Really? Is that a good excuse? I was going to tell God someday? That's what he did. Out of fear of man, he lied and sinned against God. Now he's going to justify himself in verse 12. Look at how he justified himself. Verse 12, and yet indeed she is my sister. She is the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. Well, I wasn't really totally lying. I mean, she really is my half-sister, and I'm really her half-brother, so when I said she's my sister, I wasn't lying. And she wasn't lying, except for the fact that you didn't tell that she was also your wife and you were her husband. A half truth is a full lie. He was lying. Verse 13. And it came to pass when God caused me to wander from my father's house that I said unto her, this is thy kindness which thou shalt show unto me. At every place to which we shall come, say of me, he is my brother. So that's the deal we made. You just don't ever tell him that you're married to me. Just tell him you're my sister. Verse 14, here's what Abimelech does. In verse 14, Abimelech took sheep and oxen, men servants and women servants, and gave them unto Abraham and restored him Sarah, his wife. So this guy gives a big present, a gift, and says, please, pray for me. I don't want to die over this. And verse 15, Abimelech said, behold, my land is before thee. Dwell where it pleaseth thee. And unto Sarah he said, behold, I have given thy brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, he is to thee a covering of the eyes unto all that are with thee and with all others. Thus she was reproved. He reproves them both, gives money to them. And now notice what Abraham does. Verse 17. So Abraham prayed unto God, and God healed Abimelech and his wife and his maidservants, and they bore children, for the Lord had completely closed all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. You know, when we sin, our sin always affects others. It always affects others. Sometimes it affects others more than it even hurts us. Many times it affects our children and hurts them more when we sin. But there's this issue of prophetism here. God treats his prophets very special, and there's a key function here. He said, you tell him and ask him, and he will pray for you. And so Abraham, verse 7, he says he's a prophet and he will pray for you. In verse 17, so Abraham prayed unto God, and when Abraham prayed, God answered his prayer. A prophet was to be a spokesman for God, some kind of intermediator between God and people. And Abraham, we find, is one of the first prophets in the Bible. And he's going to be speaking on behalf of God, and his ministry is a prayer. And we will find from that point on that all of these prophets, Moses being the model prophet of all the following prophets, one of their key ministries is prayer, prayer, prayer. One of my favorite passages in the Old Testament is Amos chapter 7. In Amos chapter 7, we have this prophet Amos, and God comes to him and shows him the people are done. I'm going to destroy them. And he gives Amos a vision which shows the people being destroyed. And Amos cries out, God, please don't. And in that moment, Amos goes into his prayer closet and he cries to God and he prays. And his prayer of intercession, God hears it and spares the nation. He comes out of there, he says, thank you, Lord. And then God shows him another vision. This time the vision is of another issue where he destroys the nation. And Amos says, no, please stop. And he prays, he goes in his closet and he cries to God. And a second time, God spares the nation because of the prayers of a prophet. And then God shows him a third time, a third vision. This time he says, Amos, stop. Before you go and pray this time, don't pray. It's not going to help this time. This time, I'm all done. You've prayed, you've asked, but they haven't repented. This time, they're going to be judged. Twice, Amos was able to avert the judgment through his prayers. And it's very interesting because this chapter comes right after the chapter of 19. You know what happened in chapter 19 of Genesis? That's where Sodom and Gomorrah was destroyed for its great wickedness. Do you remember what happened the chapter before that? Abraham was interceding with God. He says, well, Lord, I know you want to destroy them, but he says, will you destroy it if I find 50 righteous people in Sodom? God says, no, I won't destroy them if you can find 50. Abraham says, well, if I can find 40, will you spare for that? He says, I'll spare it if you can find 40. He says, Lord, how about 30? Lord says, 30 people? Yeah, you find 30 people, righteous people in Sodom, and I won't destroy it. And he says, can I speak again? How about 20? The Lord says, I won't destroy for 20. How about 10 finally, he says. And finally the Lord said, if you can find 10 righteous people in Sodom, I will spare the city. And Abraham finally got it down to a number where he was confident he could find 10. Because he knew of his son Lot, who was there, his nephew Lot. And he knew Lot had some sons and daughters and children. He figured there's at least 10 righteous people. Abraham is interceding as a prophet and praying for God to spare them. What happened, folks? Did he find 10? He couldn't find 10 righteous people in that city. And that's why God destroyed the city. But do you know what happened at the end of that? Look at chapter 19 for a second. Look at chapter 19 in verse 29. Genesis 19 verse 29 says, and it came to pass when God destroyed the cities of the plain that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot dwelt. You know why Lot's life was spared? Because Uncle Abraham, the prophet, prayed for him. By the way, we're not prophets today, but the ministry of prayer is still in vogue. It is still there. We can serve as priests and pray for God's people to be spared and for God to help. And so that's a great ministry. I just wanted you to see that. And so let's move on here. I want you to see quickly, what happened in chapter 22. Chapter 21, we saw that Moses or Abraham was the wavered prophet and he lies. He goes down to Jericho and he lies. That's the prelude to chapter 22. And you all know the great story of chapter 22. There's this testing of Abraham. There's a divine commentary in verse 1 of chapter 22. It says, and it came to pass after these things that God did test Abraham and said unto him, Abraham, and he said, behold, I am here. God was testing Abraham. By the way, folks, there are times I think in our lives that God will also test us. Hopefully it's not as difficult a test that he gave to Abraham. All right, the divine context is critical here. Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go into the land of Moriah and offer him there for a burnt offering upon the mountains. Really, Lord? Kill your son? Yep, that's what I want you to do. There's a response here by Abraham. Challenging problems and commendable practices. He just quickly goes and he does it. He obeys quickly, he trusts fully, and he worships honorably. He just goes and does what God told him. Now, what's the difference between Abraham in chapter 21, where he goes down to Gerar and he lies? Now in chapter 22, he's just all of a sudden a man of faith and just trusts God, and he does exactly what God tells him to do. Take your son, go to the mountain, and sacrifice him. There's a teaching responsibility. As they're going up the mountain, all of a sudden, Isaac says, Dad, we've got the fire in the wood and everything we need for the sacrifice, but where's the lamb? Can you imagine the heavy heart in Abraham wanting to tell his son but not tell him? Well, Isaac, didn't want to mention this, but you're the lamb. You're the one that God told me to sacrifice. Isaac apparently didn't know it at that point. I don't know how it all developed. I don't know at some point if Abraham told his son, now listen, son, you've got to trust me in this. God told me to do this, and so just put your hands out here. I need to tie them up. I don't know whether he hit him over the head and knocked him out and then tied him up. I don't know how it happened. At some point, his son was tied up and laid on that altar. And Abraham fully intended to go through with that. He took the knife, it says, and when he raised it to slay his son, that's when God spoke right then and said, Abraham, freeze! Don't go any further. Don't go any further. Times of testing are teachable moments, and he was teaching there. And true religion comes out there. It is not primarily an emotional response. Abraham wasn't just, emotionally, I'm not sure how he could have handled this. It's obedience. And God told him, go and do it, and Abraham did it. It may involve uncertainty. I don't know that he knew how this is going to end. In Hebrews, it tells us he was trusting, he expected fully to kill his son, because in Hebrews it says, believing that God could raise his son again. So he was, when he raised that knife, he wasn't waiting for God to stop him. He was fully ready to plunge that knife into the chest of his son, to kill him, or to slit his throat. I don't know how he was going to do it. There's a touching reality here. Precious pity. I don't know that we can fully comprehend what's going on here. There's a powerful parallel. Of course, we know this is a picturing of the fact that Jesus was like Isaac on the altar when God did not spare his son. He wouldn't allow Abraham to kill his son, but he would not spare his own son, but he took him and killed him in our behalf. So it's a prophetic picture. We understand that. This is a powerful text and so on. And, but the key thing I want you to see here for now, all right, the land of Moriah, by the way, we believe that's the exact location of Golgotha. That's where Abraham laid that altar. We believe most likely is the exact place that Jesus went on the cross when he died. In the place that Isaac spared was spared, Jesus was not spared. The father of Isaac is the father, it pictures God the Father, and son Isaac pictures God the Son. The donkey pictures man. We all have this great burden on our backs. We're burden bearers, the sin that we bear, and we can take it at the cross. The fire is the holiness and the judgment of God. And the wood is our sin that we bear. And so these are kind of parallel pictures that we see in this story. But again, the main thing I want you to see is, where is the Lamb, the patience of heaven, the pictures of sacrificial lambs, and the place? I could spend a lot of time on all of this. I just want to get through it quickly because I want you to just see, once again here, that Abraham, at this point, was at the height of his faith. He was a man that fully was engaged in doing what God wanted him to do. So now let's look at, finally, Abraham's legacy in chapter 25. Here he is, the end of his life, and there's a legacy of fame, first of all, in verses 1 through 4. It tells us, then again, Abraham took his wife, and her name was Keturah. Remember, his previous wife, Rebekah, had died. And she bore him Zimran, and Jashkan, and Medan, and Midian, and Ishbak, and Shua, and Joksim begot Sheba and Dedan, and the sons of Dedan were Ishram and Letishum and Leomim, and the sons of Midian, Ephah and Epher and Hobiah and Abdiah and Eldea, and all these were the children of Keturah. So he had several children, at least seven sons altogether. One by Sarah, one by Hagar, five by Keturah, and implied at least 17 nations here. At least 17 nations. Four by Keturah, possibly more, 12 by Ishmael, one by Isaac, and later two. Verse 23 will tell us that. And this answers the promise in Genesis 12 and in Genesis 17:4, thou shalt be the father of many nations. God said you're going to be the father of many nations. At that point, he couldn't see how it was going to happen. God gave him this opportunity. Probably no name has been more famous in the overall history of the world than Father Abraham. So he has a legacy of fame, but he's also got a legacy of fortune. In verses 5 and 6, look at the legacy of fortune. And Abraham gave all that he had unto Isaac and unto the sons of the concubines whom Abraham had. Abraham gave gifts and sent them away from Isaac his son while he yet lived eastward and unto the east country. So he had, you know, he was a multi-millionaire, probably a multi-billionaire by today's standards. And in the end, he sent all of his sons away, probably giving them enough money and gifts so that they could survive. But he gave his entire estate to Isaac. And he did this, by the way, while he still yet lived. Probably not a bad thing to do. It's probably a smart thing to do. I've seen so many people, after their death, their wills get all messed up, and it ends up in court, and it never goes the way they wanted it to. I'll never forget Pastor Hussey years ago said it this way: do your giving while you're living, then you're knowing where it's going. Pretty good advice. So keep that in mind. But so there's a legacy of fortune. There's also a legacy of faith. And this is what I want to especially dwell on. A legacy of faith. There was a life of faith. It says in verse 7, these are the days of the years of Abraham's life, which he lived in 175 years. 175 years. Then it says Abraham died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. So he lived a completely satisfied life, and his condition and his calling in life was well-pleasing to God. Full of years has a good meaning. All the desires and expectations he had were realized over and above and beyond. But he had a life of faith. He had also a faith in God's promises in verses 5 and 6. Why did he send all the other children away? Because he believed, as God had told him, that the promise, the covenant promise, was to be given through his one son, Isaac. And so he believed God's promises. He trusted God's promises. It's evidenced from his actions. And then it tells us he was buried in a cave in Machpelah. Verse 9, it says, and his sons Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Machpelah in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar the Hittite, which is before Mamre. Now, verse 9 doesn't seem like an important verse, but I want to draw your attention to it for a second. He said his sons Isaac and Ishmael. Who was his first son? Ishmael. And Isaac. At the end, they come together and they bury their dad. Don't forget, Ishmael is this son of all the Arab nations. In the very next section, we're going to come to a story about Jacob and his son, Joseph. Joseph is going to be the one with many colored coats, and the story is going to tell us that he gets sold. Guess who he gets sold to? Ishmaelites. Ishmaelites, the descendants of his grandfather. And they're the ones that buy him, take him on to Egypt, and sell him there. Verse 10 of our chapter here, the field which Abraham purchased of the sons of Heth, Abraham buried and Sarah his wife. So where he buried his wife is where he gets buried. And so that is the place there. So there's a faith in resurrection here also. Verse 8, it says the last phrase there, full of years, and was gathered to his people. There's that same phrase that is told about Abraham. I like that. Isn't that a nice way to talk about death? They say, well, he died. No, he didn't die. He was gathered to his people. There's a continuing existence once a person dies. And a couple years ago, my father died, and he was gathered to his people. And my mother died, and she was gathered to his people. In fact, we talk about the fact that, you know what, they're probably up there talking and hugging and rejoicing together. When you die in Christ, you get gathered to your people, and it's a wonderful gathering. So there's a faith in the resurrection here. And there's also wonderful faith in God. Now, let's just quickly do a quick overview of this guy by the name of Abraham. You remember the Abrahamic covenant. Don't forget that. That is so critical. There's the land and the seed and the blessing. That is the pillar, we said, of the tent pillar of the great circus tent, as it were. And all the way through the Bible, we're going to see this land, seed, blessing, this Abrahamic covenant, all the way through the Bible. Now, when we come to the end, guess what we're going to find in the book of Revelation? We're going to see that God gives land, seed, and blessing to Abraham's descendants. So keep that in mind. But in the meantime, just remember this picture of Abraham. Here we're going to look at him chapter by chapter real quickly. In chapter 12, he's a man of faith. This is where God calls him, and he leaves his old place. He goes and looks for God's place. In chapter 12, he's a man of flaws. He goes down into Abimelech's territory, and he lies. He tells him, oh, yeah, that's my sister. She says, yeah, he's my brother. They were afraid, because she was so beautiful, he was afraid they would kill him in order to get his sister, his wife. Man of flaws. Chapter 13, he gets back on track. He comes up and he builds a temple, an altar to God. In man of faith, in chapter 14, where his nephew Lot is kidnapped, and Abraham goes and he takes his army and he recovers Lot, and he comes back and he runs into this man by the name of Melchizedek. And Melchizedek blesses him and tells him how blessed he is. And Abraham, in turn, gives tithes to this Melchizedek, who happens to be the king of Salem, which is king of peace, or king of Jerusalem. Many of us think that that was probably a pre-incarnate encounter with Christ. Man of mystery and faith. Man of faith in the covenant. Now the actual covenant takes place in chapter 15. And he's a man of faith at the height, and he believes God and has counted him to righteousness, probably the time when he was saved. He's a man of flaws in chapter 16. Now he listens to his wife, and she says, well, you know what? We don't have any children. We're the covenant. God says we're going to have a nation, but I'm 90 years old. Abraham, you're how old are you? We got to have a kid. No, she was 75. You're 90. He says, we got to have children. I can't have children. Take my handmaid, Hagar, and go into her. And so Hagar becomes Abraham's wife. He listens to her, and they have a child. And this child, Ishmael, then messes up the whole family in a big way later on. He's a man of flaws. He's not trusting God. He's not believing God. He didn't consult God on that. He just made his decision based on his wife's conniving. But in chapter 17, after Ishmael's born, a few years later, he's a man of faith again. And the covenant is being taken. And there's an official covenant done there. It's amazing to hear that. God says, all right, let's do the circumcision there. In chapter 18, he's a man of faith, and he's interceding on behalf of his nephew Lot. Don't destroy them. That's where we hear that story. And God says, I won't destroy him. He is interceding, a man of faith. A man of faith in chapter 19, while God is destroying Sodom and Gomorrah, Abraham is trusting God, and he's learning. And that story reminds us there's a major contrast between Lot and Abraham. Lot failed. Abraham is the man of faith. In chapter 20, we saw him again just a few moments ago. He's a man of flaws. He didn't trust God. He went back and he did the same thing, deja vu all over again. He lied and said, well, she's my sister and he's my brother. A man of faith. Birth of Isaac. There he goes. God comes back and he delivers him. In chapter 22, a man of faith again offers Isaac. A man of faith when Sarah dies, and a man of faith when he gets a bride for Isaac. And there's the entire life of Abraham. You see, there's at least three times when he fell, and he had some flaws, some key problems there. And now let's just take a look at it, a visual picture of the life of Abraham. Here it is. That's what he looks like. Is that the way your life looks sometimes? Sometimes you're a man of faith or a woman of faith. And sometimes you're a man of flaws. Sometimes you tell lies and make mistakes in your life. And sometimes you are on the mountaintop and things are really excited. Sometimes you're listening to God and sometimes you're failing. And here we have the life of Abraham that just shows us, you know what? He is well known in the Bible to be a man of faith. But we must never forget that he was a human being just like you and me. And we can be encouraged to see all of these things that took place in his life. And you might have times of mountaintop experience, and you might have times of failure. But let us always come back and remember that God wants us to come back and get on track, and God can bless us and use us. So that's a wonderful picture. Just wanted to do that little reminder of one of the greatest men in the Bible, and how you need to recognize that sometimes we compare ourselves to these great men of the Bible, Abraham and David and Moses and Joshua and whoever else. Every one of them had failures. Every one of them had highs and lows and peaks and valleys. And you and I, we need to also be careful and make sure that we can also come back to God and live. It's how we finish, folks. When you fall, get back up and get going. God has a plan for you.